and welcome to Minute 93 of Season 3 of Movie Raw Minute, the daily podcast where we yippee-ki-yay our way through the 1988 Bruce Willis action flick Die Hard, one minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me today once again is Jim O'Kane, a producer of so many different Movies by Minute programs and a great podcaster and someone that we all aspire to be like when we're doing Movies by Minute podcasts, especially with the kinds of guests that he gets on his shows. So welcome to the show, Jim.
Oh, well, thank you very much for that introduction. I don't deserve it, but this gets to be habit forming, doesn't it, Rob? I mean, when you start making one, it's like, and you keep thinking of new movies that you want to do.
And so there's too many of them. That's the problem.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's not enough hours in a day, but yes. Yeah, we still managed to squeeze them in and get some episodes recorded
so that people can listen. For sure. And, so minute 93 begins with Hans looking at John devilishly and ends with Hans concealing some evidence. So yesterday we ended things with, John and Hans having a little bit of a conversation. Hans tries to lure John into a trap. John doesn't fall for it, whether on purpose or not, doesn't happen. And today's episode, we get just a few seconds. I think it's like even 1.5 seconds of the face of Hans as he's looking on, he's got a very strange, mischievous look on his face as we get to see that. And then the scene just changes. And now we get to see we're back at the police, barricade. We get to see Little Johnson.
It has a very much a feeling of watching some kind of sports. I mean, it's like you're watching the game is in progress between McClane and Hans, and you go back to the commentators, which are up in the up in the booth away from it all, and they're Big Johnson and Little Johnson are talking with Dwayne T. Robinson about how things going so far, and Robinson gives them the rundown of it, telling them there's hostages and they're probably floor they're on and.
One of the things, Robinson starts off and he says, well, the best we can figure, and again, what do you mean the best we can figure? This is all information you got from John. Because we've got maybe 30, 35 hostages up there, probably on the 30th floor. Again, that's a fact that John has told them. It's as if Robinson is not, doesn't believe John as a source.
Yeah. Yeah, he's very dubious of any information that he's getting there, but he's always willing to take credit for the intelligence that he's referring for the FBI. He's telling there's 7 or 8 terrorists, there's 35 people, and they're all trapped probably on the 30th floor.
And he goes, maybe 7 or 8 terrorists up there.
Yeah, exactly.
And then Big Johnson, once again, Robert Davi, in a very firm voice, looks over and goes, sounds like an A7 scenario. So I looked it up. I couldn't find any real A7 scenario. It sounds very official.
Yeah. It sounds like there's a playbook. Somewhere there's a playbook, and it's like, he's gonna run, right field, and it sounds like they know if it's this, then they're going to do this, and this is how they're going to handle it. And the funny thing is that this is exactly what Hans was expecting. He said, they're going to do this, they're going to turn off the power, they're going to do this and that. And he knows the FBI's playbook, so they're already playing into his hands just by, throwing out these technical-sounding numbers. And he was just waiting. Hans has been waiting for the FBI to arrive. So everything's going Hans's way, except for the problem of the man that's in front of him.
Yes.
And we are like the FBI is very sure of themselves. They tell them that they're going to hand them.
They're pompous. Gonna all handle it. The way that Little Johnson responds, he goes, thank you. We'll handle it from here. When we commandeer your men, we'll try and let you know. So he's saying, when we take your men and tell them what to do, maybe we'll let you know.
Yeah. It's, just straight out cannon fodder, but, they'll keep them updated. Send them occasional reports after actions and stuff.
But it's a good thing that and it's very funny because Big Johnson like sniffles as he's like looking around, and he actually looks really bored. You know, this is an A7 scenario. We know how to deal with this. You know, and he pulls out like a pack of cigarettes from his jacket pocket as we get our good friend Al to intercede here, and he goes, "Aren't you forgetting something?" And Big Johnson looks at him and goes, "Such as?" He says, "What about John McClane? He's the reason why we have the information we have up until now." So Al is fighting for John. You know, he's a great advocate here to say that you know, John, there's a reason why John is there. He's helping us, you know, and we need to help him in the same way. You know, and then he goes, he's also the reason why you're facing 7 terrorists instead of 12. So first of all, I love the fact that throughout this entire movie, have you ever counted the number of terrorists that there are?
It varies. If I remember correctly, there's not, it doesn't,
it doesn't
say,
how can it vary? No, I'm saying how many actual terrorists are there?
Are there 12?
No.
I don't have that count. I don't
there
know.
Are 13.
Including Hans, I guess.
Including Hans, yes.
Yeah.
But I mean, I don't think anyone is saying, okay, we're gonna count them, but we're not counting the lead guy because he's a thief. No.
Yeah. I thought if I remember when we were going through Die Hard, there's somebody that dies and we don't know where they actually died in the film.
No, there's someone who survives. You have you have Christoph.
That's what it is. That's what it is at the end. Yes.
You have Christoph who gets you know, belted in the face, and that's it.
Yeah.
And then you know, and then the Barabans go flying all over the floor.
Right. That's what it was.
So he's the 13th guy. So I mean, I remember back in the 80s, I had a poster on my wall of this movie, and the you know, on the poster it says 12 terrorists take over Nakatomi Plaza, and I'm thinking to myself, and I knew the movie well enough at the time, and I'm like, even on the poster they're getting it wrong.
Yeah.
It's 13, not 12. Don't you know how to count?
Wow, they meant 12 henchmen. That's what.
Yes, 12 henchmen. 12 henchmen.
No,
but again, they're not. No one has even. There's no way of even proving that there was 12. I mean, John hasn't seen all 12 of them, or 13 of them.
No, he hasn't. You know, he hasn't been in the big room. He hasn't seen. You know, right, he hasn't seen the guys at the, you know, the guys in the computer room working on that. They're out of the picture for him. He doesn't.
Correct.
Yeah.
So like the question is, where do they get the number 12? So they just say, oh, well, you know, they can't do this with 9 guys. They had to have 12, you know?
Yeah. I mean,
must've been a dozen, or at least the baker's dozen, you know,
or, what, I talked with the screenwriter, Danny Bilson. And he said, much of this, if you're not sure of things, he says it's known as plausible off-screen action. So if you have something going on that you're not quite sure about, you can just say it's a POA, plausible off-screen action. Like maybe McClane stopped, you know, somehow got to the computer room and had written more names on his arm, we just didn't see that at the time because other things were going on, or you know, we were down on the ground here. But
yeah, wait, so that does that mean that John just doesn't know how to count?
It could be. It's just hopefully he, you know, he's been, and how many, I'm not sure if we ever had the full conversation where he had with Al to tell him how many people were there.
Yeah, I mean, we did.
Okay, yeah, that I'm doing the reread on the, as I'm doing the review on this, I've watched this week's, but trying to remember where things were in the picture gets a little
funny. Yeah, from... they do mention that already.
Yeah. Al is, of course, John McClane's brother in arms.
Yes.
And so he's always, you know, looking out for a fellow cop and, you know, pointing out John McClane. And it's kind of, revealing that, you know, Robinson said he might be a cop. I don't know. And the Johnson say, you know, is it one of yours? And Robinson immediately denies him. Says, no, no way. No way. And it's like, well, you've got Al here who would probably be doing the same thing if he were up, you know, maybe not as athletically as John McClane was doing, but he would be in the same, putting himself in the line of fire kind of, kind of a reaction to stuff.
Yeah.
So the fact that Dwayne T. Robinson doesn't understand what it means to be a cop and be a, you know, someone to protect and serve.
He's just a bureaucrat.
What's
great, I don't know if you noticed this. I only noticed this time. I've seen this movie dozens, if not hundreds of times, right? But when Al is advocating for John, so we get a shot of Robinson, and he makes a motion with his hands next to his mouth as if to say to Powell, zip it.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and I've never noticed that before, you know, seeing it here. And then, you know, we have the conversation with the Johnsons, and that's when little Johnson says, he's inside, who is he? And then Robinson goes, well, he might be a cop. He might be a cop again. You know, he doesn't have a second source. You know, he's got just the fact that Ellis has said he's a cop. That's it. Nothing else.
Yeah.
I don't know. We're checking on it. And then Big Johnson says, one of yours? No, no way. Now, first of all, I love how the Johnsons are, they're a great tag team.
Yeah.
You know, they let these conversations go, and each time a different one of them is responding.
Yeah, it's just and it seems like just to pass the time. They're not really care about the information that they're being fed, or like the little things that they don't know. It's amazing what they don't know. They don't know who McClane is. That, right. You know, the FBI wouldn't be able to figure this out in a moment as whether he was a cop. Of course, you know, the other thing that we have to think about,
they didn't have the internet.
Yeah, and it's Christmas Eve. You know, you've got the skeleton crew on, the people who couldn't get off for Christmas Eve. Are working the boards, and they probably, if you're calling the non-emergency number at the the human resources department of the city of New York, nobody's answering, because it's nighttime here. It's like 7 o'clock here. It's probably 11 o'clock at night.
No, first of all, it's not 7 o'clock here. Here it's already 11, 12 o'clock at night.
Okay, yeah. I'm sorry. Even like at the start of the party, it's going into the next day. It's Christmas in New York already. So they can't. The people that they'd normally get in touch with, they're all out. They're all on vacation somewhere. So it's very limited in the information that they can get. And I would think that it would even be a problem for the FBI getting a hold of this information. And like you said, it's before the internet. They'd have to send out teletypes.
Right. I mean, they had the internet, but nobody knew about it. You know, only a fortunate few knew what the internet was back in 1988. And
Yeah.
Did you know about the internet in 88?
I knew about bulletin boards. That was about it. You know, you'd be dialing into FidoNet and stuff, and using FidoNet mail that would you'd send out an email, and then maybe 4 days later it would come back to you with, you know, people that had attached messages to it. But using that and that kind of stuff. But yeah, I mean, it's like you couldn't really make, and we've talked about this on the other Die Hard Minute show, that you couldn't make this movie right now because everybody would have a cell phone. Everybody would be able to inform people about what's going on. And the, you know, 12 or 13 terrorists couldn't take over the building because there's too many routes of communication out of the building.
Right.
Unless, you know, they destroyed every cell tower in the neighborhood. I'm sure they would have, I mean, the way you'd rewrite it is that there'd be some kind of a jamming box that would jam all the cell phones.
Right. Exactly. But, you know, this is one of those movies, and actually I'm an advocate of most movies, that you don't need to remake them. If they're done right the first time, then, you know, there's not much you can try and change.
Wow. So,
you know, I mean, I heard when I was doing Planes, Trains, Automobiles. So, you know, there were rumors that Will Smith and I think Martin Lawrence were making a Planes, Trains, Automobiles remake. And that is another idea that I said to myself, how could you do that today? Because, again, if you had a cell phone, that solves all of your problems.
Everything. Yeah. Yeah, every miscommunication. I mean, if you rely on miscommunication as a thing, this is I guess everything that is done like that now would be a period piece.
Yes.
In the future, you know, it's
in the past.
Different world. Yeah. I mean, that's like even gosh, when they made Hunt for Red October, the Soviet Union had disappeared, and they still had this great property that they had to do. So they had to, you know, they had to come, they had to preface the movie with, by the way, this is before, you know, before the fall of the Soviet Union.
Yeah, I actually just saw it last week. I watched it again last week. I love that movie. It's a great movie.
It's a great film. Yeah, that's, and nobody's done a minute of that yet. So
it's
it would be there's very worthwhile. Yeah,
that movie has too many quiet moments, let's put it that way.
There's little islands of action followed by a lot of nothing.
Right, it has to be a lot of, if anyone does it, it has to be someone who really knows a lot about sonar and you know,
yeah,
and the Bering Sea, you know, the different routes along the Bering Sea.
Being able to talk about that, you know, get a couple of submariners on there.
Thor's maybe twins, you know,
that definitely a 5 minutes at a time. I don't think you could do it a minute at a time, but I think you could do it in 5 minute chunks.
Right. Okay.
Sure. But someday we'll see.
Add that to your list, Jim. There you go.
Yeah. Just try and get Alec Baldwin on the show.
He's probably looking for work these days. So maybe.
Yeah. He might have some free time. We'll see. So we go back from them talking about how the LAPD are not NYPD police for some reason, but we wind up back with on the 35th floor, and McLean is offering Gruber a cigarette, which is another thing that you don't do in modern movies. Cigarettes are kind of
taboo,
verboten.
How many okay, he shows him the pack, and there are two cigarettes in there. How many do you know how many cigarettes are in a pack?
Are there 20?
Yes,
I think
there are 20.
Yeah.
So it means that that between John and what was his name?
Tony.
Tony, there you go. I blanked on that for a second. So between John and Tony, they've smoked 18 cigarettes.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, it's been a hectic day. Yeah, you got to relax.
Yes. So he takes the two cigarettes that are left. First, he looks into the pack and sees them, and then he offers them to he looks at them, picks it up, and you see that Hans is leaning up against a floor directory behind him that we'll talk more about that tomorrow. I got a lot to say about that one tomorrow, because we get clearer shots of that one. And, then John takes one of the cigarettes and pulls it out with his lips, and then hands hands the packet over to Hans in order for him to get the last cigarette. And at this point, he says to him, do you smoke? And he goes, yeah. And then he takes the cigarette and says, thanks. And then Hans does a very strange thing. He takes the empty pack and puts it in his pocket.
Yeah,
which is very strange. Like, why? So, like, at the beginning of the minute, when I said that the minute ends with Hans concealing evidence, could it be that that's what he's doing here? You know, the idea that John was talking about the fact that their cigarettes show that they're European.
Yeah.
So maybe he's just taking that, or it could just be, that's his reaction.
Force of habit at all.
Instead of just throwing the pack on the floor, just you put it in your jacket pocket and that's it.
Yeah. Or I'm just thinking that putting in his jacket pocket to find out whether his walkie-talkie, which he might need later, is still available and not, is in the pocket where he's putting the thing, just to be ready in the future if he needed a call for help.
Oh, that's interesting. I never thought about that. That's a good point.
It's although, if he had thought about that he could have used that same pocket to have put the pistol in instead of leaving it on a shelf. I don't know. It's equal parts brilliant and kind of dumb. It's an intriguing one. And I was trying to find any cigarette. I was looking for European cigarettes with a sky blue pack, and I've never been able to find one. It's something that I thought would be, maybe they were trying to make it look like something else. The closest I could think of is Hitani, which is a French cigarette. There's one called Galloway's Caporal, which is the sky blue. So I'm assuming that those might be there. I'm probably saying that wrong. Galloway's, it's like Hitani means gypsy, but I don't know what Galloway's means. But they're those the cigarettes that they have there. It's part of, from what I'm understanding, it's been part of French identity since they were first introduced in 1910. Like it's a classic French cigarette. That it was a the Hitani was kind of a woman's cigarette, while the Galloway's was a kind of like the Marlboro. It was like a cowboy thing. Galloway's is like a French Viking, and there's a the image on the front of it is a Viking helmet. So the that's the only sky blue one I could figure, and I don't know if that was still popular. I mean, they were out in 1910, but it may be that it continued into the 80s. I know the weird thing with Hitani cigarettes is when you smoke them, the smoke isn't gray; it's kind of black. It looks like exhaust fumes. It's very, very rough. I don't smoke. I didn't smoke, but from what I understand, it's a pretty rough go if you're smoking them.
Yeah, I couldn't tell you that one.
It's interesting to see. Yeah, I don't know enough about French cigarettes. I worked at Airbus for a while, but all the Airbus people smoked American cigarettes. It's a certain look. I mean, it's the kind of thing that you'd see Jean-Paul Belmondo, you know, chuffing away in a 1960 film. So it's yeah, but like you said, it could be that he's trying to hide the European thing. But McLean has already seen the pack, so I don't know if he's hiding how much it's working.
Right.
Wow. It's an interesting minute. Very very intriguing. Where I mean, it's placed right now. It's placed as being showing the weakness of FBI being kind of dismissive of all other information, saying that, you know, they know what they're doing. They've done it all before. And it's, you know, showing that Hans really knew.
But what it also shows is that they don't really care. You know, this is for them. This is something this is run of the mill for them.
Yeah. Yeah. And how many ever hostages there are on the 30th floor. So, you know, there could be collateral damage. But
they'll talk about that later. Important. They just don't care. You know, all right.
Yeah.
We'll have a little bit of, so there'll be a little bit of collateral. I can live with that. That's what he said.
Yeah.
You know, what was it, 20, 25% or something like that they say? And say, yeah, I can live with that. Yeah. You'd think that that they would be a little bit more caring about the fact that, you know, they should be trying to help the hostages, maybe.
Yeah. Like the only goal here is to neutralize the terrorist, whatever it takes. It doesn't matter if the building gets blown up or if people die. It's just let's wipe out terrorism. And it's, you know, bring in the heavy equipment, bring in the, well, we'll get into that later, but the helicopters and the tanks are on their way.
Yeah.
And it's just not it's not going to be a life-saving operation.
No, definitely not. Because they just don't care about it.
No.
You know, that's what it comes down to. I mean,
it shows that quite nicely without having, you know, there's a nice subtext there, and in both, you know, both on the ground and up in the. Up in the building,
right? We'll probably get into this many weeks from now. But you know, the question is how does Hans know what the FBI plan is? You know, again, he didn't have the internet to try and find it out. So at some point, you know, he needs to figure out how to get this classified information as to, you know, what their tactics are and their scenarios and things like that.
Yeah. Yeah, his network of his network in his own built up intelligent network seems to have just as much information, more than enough information about the FBI than the FBI has about them.
Correct. Correct.
I mean, the FBI is still thinking that it's a terrorism. Yeah. Yeah, he still thinks it's a terrorist organization. It's just a team getting ready for a heist.
Right. Well, no, but that's partially because of the facade that, you know, Hans is supposedly a terrorist. You know, they had the whole idea where the terrorist group that he worked for, you know, disassociated themselves from him. You know, like hours before the attack. You know, which as far as I can tell, that's being done in order for him to, you know, use that more as a plausible reason for, you know, for them knowing that, okay, Hans is the guy who's dealing with this, and now he's dead and nobody cares. You know, no, you can't look for him.
Yeah.
You know, we're not going to look for him anymore because he's dead. So,
it's amazing. The script on this is just amazing that it really, it's all these different stakes, all the different characters, and the idea of putting all this together and being able to follow the pieces as we've been doing minute by minute, being able to see how the pieces start stacking up like so many, you know, Jenga.
Yes.
It's amazing how strong it stays through the whole course of the film. You're always aware of the stakes. You're always aware of what both sides are doing. And, you know that it's going to come to a rather stunning conclusion. So it's just, it's a great roller coaster ride. And this is, again, a minute that just starts. This minute is like when you're riding the part of the roller coaster that goes clack, 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 that's taking you up the side. They're getting all the pieces in place for the next big scene.
Where at the same time, you feel your stomach starting to churn. Because you know what you're expecting, but you don't know what you're expecting at the exact same time.
Exactly. Yeah, that's right on target.
Yeah.
Wow.
Great. Okay. Do you have anything else you want to say about this minute before we get into the script?
No. Then it's a great one. Go ahead and we'll find out the words that started it all.
Right. So the script, the conversation between Robinson and the Johnsons pretty much stays the same. Powell has a few things that he says differently. He goes, he says, John McClane, he's the man who gave us all the information, as opposed to the way that they stated here was he's the reason why we have the information. Again, you know, it probably is just the way that Reginald Vell Johnson remembered it when they were filming. But then there's a response from Big Johnson where after Robinson says that no, sir, he's not one of mine. So Big Johnson goes, well, if he's not a terrorist and he's not a hostage, he's just not part of the equation. And then the two of them start walking away. And then Powell says, that's the same goddamn thing the terrorist said. And then Little Johnson turns around and is interested and goes, really? And then he turns to Big Johnson and goes, that's one good thing. Sounds like we're dealing with pros. And then they walk out of there. I mean, again, I'm glad they cut it out. I don't think it really adds anything to it, but it's just funny reading those extra lines. And then when John and Hans are back together, there's a little difference there also. It says, McClane and Hans walk together. Hans is still a nervous wreck. Hans, there was a party, celebration. All of a sudden, they were there, shooting, threatening us. McClane looks at this poor civilian on the edge of going to pieces. He puts his hand on his shoulder. Relax, man. You smoke? Hans nods, still frightened. McClane takes out his spoils of war, the Marlboros, which again are not European. Two left, he sighs. Takes one, offers the other with an expression like a little boy forced to share a cookie. McClane takes out a lighter, does his, and Hans nods, grateful, then peers at McClane. So it's interesting. I love in all scripts the descriptive nature of them, you know, the way that they're able to really describe everything that's going on, you know, things that you normally don't think about.
Yeah. Yeah. And you can hear what the screenwriter had in their mind when they were writing it.
Yeah.
Versus what the director saw as he was trying to present it.
Correct.
Watching things going from page to screen is always a fascinating process. I think it's pretty true to everything, pretty true to the main storyline. It's just interesting seeing that, how much of this is probably improv, or that was thought up on the, on the set.
Yeah.
And it's like, how about you try it this way? And they, might have filmed it three different ways, and then I'll do it that way, and then do another one. But it all just feels, again, these scenes, even though it's cartoonish with the FBI guys, it still feels more organic than what's coming off the page.
Yeah, for sure. That works much better. Yep. All right. So every Wednesday we have a segment called Hans Hunt Day, where my guests will give their top five Alan Rickman films. So what have you got for us?
Now I've got to find my... I had the piece of paper right here. Well, I can't remember them offhand. Of course, Die Hard is one of my top...
okay, Alan, but do films. I think this do, is... I want you to rank them. Five through one, so that I can count up the points.
Ooh, okay. Okay, well, in that case, Die Hard's going to fall in at number two.
Go in order.
I'm sorry. Yeah, okay.
With five.
I'm trying to find my paper. Five is Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves. And I think what happened, I don't like the movie Prince of Thieves because I think it's way too Americanized. And I think Alan Rickman is the only British actor. Well, except for the guy at the very end. If you haven't seen it, I won't spoil it. But seeing Robin Hood, he was a great villain in that because he was acting as they say, the villain is the hero in his own story. And I think that he played it as the villain, as hero in his own story. And he comes across very well on that. Number four, I would put as Dogma, where he plays the angel metronaut. He's the voice of the creator, and being the case that if the Almighty ever spoke to you directly, the sheer magnitude, the magnificence of God would destroy you. So he acts as the voice of God, and he plays it with. It's simultaneously cynical and hopeful. He comes across as very wry, very dry wit, and I thought that he played it just right. It was a difficult part, but I thought he played it. He played it very straight. It's a comedy. It's a and I thought he played it very, very straight with that. Number three, I would put as Die Hard. That's where Die Hard would fit in for me. I think it's an excellent showcase for him. It definitely showed his early strengths in the blockbuster films. This was a great showing of how powerful an actor he was to carry a movie. Between him and the two main people in this are Bruce Willis and Alan Rickman. And I would say that Alan Rickman is actually the star of Die Hard more than Bruce Willis.
Okay. That's fair. You do know that this is his first acting role, right? First on screen.
Yeah,
acting role.
Yeah, and this is his showcase that he. I mean, he had done television before, I believe.
Yeah.
But his big movie role. This made him the star, and the amount of stuff that was put on his shoulders to carry this movie is amazing. I know a lot of number ones people would do for Alan Rickman. Would be my number two, which is Galaxy Quest. Galaxy Quest, he comes across as his most cynical, as his most sourpuss character that he's just, he's slogging through on it. The great line of after this major space battle, he wanders off the bridge of the spaceship and Tim Allen asks him, "Where are you going?" And he says, "To find a pub." I mean, that's just his ultimate line. It's just great in his cynicism and groundedness. Whereas, Tim Allen is the hero of the movie. The audience sensibility, I think, sits with both Sigourney Weaver and with Alan Rickman. As if you're presented with a crazy situation like this, this is probably how anybody else would react. The number one film, and this is probably something that not a lot of people have seen. But I think it's one of his best films simply because It doesn't involve explosions. It doesn't involve CGI. It doesn't involve him wearing any kind of makeup or costume, or he doesn't even have to play a bad guy in this. It's an indie film. I think it was Fox Searchlight, but I'm not sure. It's called Bottle Shock.
Okay.
And it's such a great, it's a great little gem of a film. It's very, it's character driven. It's about, in 1976, a British expat living in Paris was running a winery, a wine shop. And through his actions and interactions with, people in California, he created what was known as the California Revolution, where, the wineries of California, Napa Valley specifically, were brought to France, and in a blind taste test, they beat French wines in blind taste tests and received awards. And that actually changed the entire California wine industry, just based on the actions of this one man in his little wine shop. Rickman gives one of the best performances. It's one of his final performances on screen, but it's worth seeing how much he can create the small character and carry it through the whole movie. I think it shows his strength, his maturity as an actor, his ability to get into any type of a script. I mean, he's done comedy, he's done action, he's done science fiction, but this whole idea of being a close, simple man who's, you know, faced with, titanic forces against him of the entire French wine industry and the burgeoning California wine industry. I can't recommend it enough. If you get a chance, the movie Bottle Shock is well worth your time. It's well worth, you know, whatever, 2 hours of your time. But that's my number one.
All right, great. So you want to once again tell people how they can get in touch with Jim O'Kane.
I've got all of my podcasts are available at a site that I like to call, and it happens to be named jimokane.com. It's JIMOKANE.com. You can follow all my podcasts, all my websites, all the video stuff I've done in the past and the audio stuff. You can just basically swim in my podcast history out there. But jimokane.com is probably the easiest place to find all of my stuff.
All right, great. And while you're doing that, you can go rate, review, and subscribe on any podcatcher you might be using to listen to this show. Finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Rob Minute. You can find me on Facebook. You can find me on Twitter. And you can go directly to my website, movierobminute.com. So, until tomorrow, yippee-ki-yay!
Yippee-ki-yay!